Good morning. My name is Ruth and I'm one of the pastors here at Cedar Ridge. And today we're going to be wrapping up our series, Uncomfortable Conversations with Jesus, with a message called, What is Truth? We're going to be looking at the story we just heard of Jesus being questioned by Pontius Pilate. Throughout this series, we've been exploring some uncomfortable conversations that Jesus had with a range of people and asking what we can learn from them that we can apply to our own conversations, conversations maybe that we're having or that we need to have, particularly around difficult or contentious issues. As far as uncomfortable conversations go, being tried for treason, facing torture and execution if you're found guilty, that's got to be up there. This is a high stakes, very uncomfortable conversation that we're looking at today. And it centers around Pontius Pilate, who is, I think, a fascinating character. He has these great lines in scripture like, what is truth? And behold the man, in what I have written, I have written. But he's presented a little differently in each of the gospel accounts, which may reflect the different sources that the authors use, but it also reflects the audience that the gospel was being written for and their particular relationship to Rome. So if you try and bring those four accounts together, Pilate can seem rather enigmatic. It makes you wonder, what kind of a person was he really? And what happened to him after Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection? Was he troubled by his interaction with Jesus, as some accounts seem to suggest? Was he maybe haunted by the memory of what he'd done? Did he hear and believe the stories of the resurrection? Or did he not even give Jesus a second thought? What happened? Well, we don't know. But there are many, many legends about what happened to Pilate in later life. They don't seem to have any historical basis, they're just stories. But it's interesting that of the earliest versions from the 4th and 5th century that are still around today, 7 of them talk about Pilate's death. And in 4 of these, Pilate continues to be a very bad character. He's cruel, he's violent, and he ends up either dying by suicide or by being executed in a very gruesome way. But in the other 3 of these early legends, Pilate becomes a follower of Jesus and is subsequently martyred for his faith, again, in a pretty gruesome way. It seems all the writers agree that Pilate deserves a grisly end. But on the basis of those latter legends where he becomes a martyr, in the Coptic Church in Egypt and the Orthodox Church in Ethiopia, Pilate is actually venerated as a saint, which is a little odd, I think. As I said, these are just legends. They're written at least a few hundred years after the events, and they were clearly written with a very political agenda. But the Gospels, too, are written with an agenda, as we mentioned. They're written for specific people in a particular social, religious, and political context. And that impacts how the writers tell the story of Jesus and present the other characters, such as Pilate. We read this morning from John's Gospel, and the writer of that Gospel is very explicit about his reason for writing. He ends the book like this. Jesus performed many other signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. So the author is very explicit. He's not trying to write an orderly account like the author of Luke, for example. He's writing so that people will find life through believing in Jesus, the Messiah, the Son of God. You might remember we read another story from John's Gospel a few weeks ago, and that was the story of Nicodemus. And Matthew then talks about how belief in John's Gospel is not about acknowledging certain facts, but it's about ongoing trust. It's an active verb. It has a strong relational aspect. So the writer is wanting people to have an ongoing relational trust in Jesus as the Son of God. And the writer describes at some length throughout his book what it means for Jesus to be the Son of God. So in chapter 5, for example, he writes, because Jesus was doing these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, my Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working. For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only was he breaking the Sabbath, that was by healing on the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. And later in chapter 14, the writer records Jesus as saying this, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I am in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. So Jesus, as the Son of God, is in the Father. The Father is in him. He shares the same functions as the Father, judging and bringing life. And to see the Son is to see the Father. These are very strong statements about Jesus' oneness with God the Father. And we see in today's reading that this actually forms the basis of one of the charges brought against Jesus. We read in chapter 19, the Jewish leaders insisted, "We have a law, and according to that law, he must die, because he claimed to be the Son of God." Or literally, he is making himself the Son of God. So this gospel was written very intentionally, not as a straightforward history, but as a way to help people believe. That's not to say, of course, that it didn't happen. I'm not saying that at all. But clearly, the content is carefully fashioned with the end goal in mind. Throughout John's gospel, we find a number of people who encounter Jesus and have a long conversation with him, in which they explore whether or not they believe he is the Son of God, that source of life. So we looked at Nicodemus a few weeks ago. Other stories in John's gospel include the woman at the well, the man born blind, Mary and Martha, Peter, and others. Sometimes it's just a discussion with the crowd. But these are all conversations in which people are thinking through, is Jesus the Messiah, the Son of God? And the point of the conversation is never to gain knowledge or to learn good theology, but it's to understand who Jesus really is, and to trust in Jesus in a relational way, and so experience real life. In many of these conversations in John's Gospel, people misunderstand what Jesus is talking about. We saw that in the story of Nicodemus. When Jesus told him he needed to be reborn, Nicodemus asked how anyone could re-enter their mother's womb. Jesus tells the woman at the well in the next chapter that he can give her living water, and she responds, "But you haven't got a bucket." Jesus tells Martha her brother Lazarus will rise from the dead, and she says, "Yes, on the last day," and so on. People misunderstand what Jesus is trying to say in many of these conversations. And at the end of the conversation, some people get it and some people don't. And the writer of John seems quite dualistic. You either get it or you don't. You either belong to the light or the darkness. You're born of spirit or you're born of flesh. You're from above or you're from this world, and so on. There is very little room for gray in this gospel. No one is really neutral. That doesn't seem to really be an option for this writer. And we see these patterns in today's story. Pilate meets Jesus. He has a long conversation. There's lots of misunderstanding. And Pilate has to decide, who is Jesus? Is he the Messiah, the Son of God, or not? And then what are the implications of that? Before we get into today's text, let's give a bit of background on Pontius Pilate. He's a historical figure attested to outside of scripture. He was the fifth governor of the Roman province of Judea, which was a third class imperial province, meaning it was small. On this map, it's the area under Galilee consisting of Samaria, Judea, and Idumea, which altogether is about the size, a third of the size of Maryland. And a third class imperial province also meant that it wasn't a good revenue generator. So it's really not an important place to Rome. And it was troublesome. It included Jewish people who had mounted numerous uprisings against the Roman authorities. It included Samaritans who had their own uprisings against Rome. And of course, they hated the Jews and vice versa. So there's friction between these two groups, as well as friction from those groups with Rome. And there were also two majority pagan cities, Caesarea and Sebaste. So there was lots of tension and conflict in a very small province. Pilate held the office of governor from 26 to 36 or 37 CE. So he had about 10 years in office, which was actually a long time. Most governors moved on after 2 to 4 years. But Tiberius, who was emperor at the time, saw no reason to move people around as long as they were doing a reasonable job. Tiberius was also known for choosing mediocre governors. He didn't want anyone to outshine him and potentially become a threat. So Pilate, it seems, was in that sweet spot of being reasonably competent, but not too impressive. As governor, Pilate had military and judicial authority, and he was responsible for tax collection. But he had very few staff to get the job done. As a third-class province, there was only a very limited Roman presence. The soldiers would have been auxiliary troops, meaning that they weren't Roman citizens. Theoretically, Pilate should have been able to call on the protection and the guidance of the more powerful governor of neighboring Syria, who had four Roman legions at his disposal. But unfortunately for Pilate, for the first 6 years of his rule, the Syrian governors were working from home. How very 2020 of them. They were based in Rome, and so he got no support from Syria, which meant that Pilate had to rely to a very great extent upon the cooperation of local authorities. Governors generally would appoint certain families to positions of power and keep them there for as long as they were loyal to Rome and do nasty things to them if they weren't loyal to Rome. So Pilate's predecessor had, for example, installed a previously unknown family to the highest ranks of the Jewish priesthood, Annas, his son-in-law Caiaphas, who was mentioned in today's reading, and three of his sons were consecutively appointed to the office of high priest by the Roman governor. So these were supposed to be his men working alongside him. Pilate lived in Caesarea on the coast, but he would come into Jerusalem to keep order at the festivals when the population swelled and there was a surge of nationalistic feeling, and therefore there was a greater potential for uprisings. Pilate seems to have been, in many ways, an unremarkable governor. We know he built something in honor of Emperor Tiberius, but we don't know what, because only the inscription stone remains. We know he built or extended an aqueduct in Jerusalem. And in fact, just last year, the Israeli Antiquities Authority uncovered a walkway that's connected to the aqueduct, which you can see in this picture. And we know he had something of a reputation for being a bit of a heavy-handed ruler. The Jewish historian Josephus recounts that Pilate drained the temple treasury to fund the building of this aqueduct. And when protesters amassed, he dispatched plainclothes soldiers to infiltrate the crowd. On his signal, they pulled out clubs that were hidden in their garments and beat many of the protesters to death. Similarly, the Roman historian Tacitus states that Pilate was removed from office after 10 years and sent back to Rome for questioning because he had used excessive force to put down a suspected Samaritan insurrection. So he seems to have been quite brutal at times. But he could also be pragmatic. When he was still new to his post, Pilate stationed troops in Jerusalem who carried military standards that bore the image of the emperor. You might remember from a couple of weeks ago, we were looking at the Pharisees' question about paying taxes, and we said that Jewish people considered images of the emperor, or images of people in general, but particularly images of the emperor, to be idolatry. And so in this instance, indeed, the religious leaders were incensed at Pilate for allowing these troops into Jerusalem carrying these images of the emperor. And a great crowd of them went to Caesarea, where Pilate resided, and lay prostrate around Pilate's palace for 5 days. He threatened to behead them all, and they called his bluff. They said, fine, execute us. And he backed down. So from what we know, Pilate seems to have been somewhat brutal, certainly arrogant, but not unusually violent or cruel for someone in that position. It's a pretty low bar, but still. He seems to have learnt during his time as governor to be at least somewhat sensitive to religious customs, Jewish religious customs, so as to avoid trouble. And although he clearly despised the Jewish religious leaders, he also worked with them. As we mentioned, he really didn't have an option. And we see all these dynamics at play in today's passage. And we'll see the animosity between Pilate and the Jewish religious leaders. But we also see that they are working together to deal with Jesus. In fact, in the story of Jesus' arrest in John's Gospel, the writer says this: Judas had promised to betray Jesus, so he went to the garden with some Roman soldiers and temple police who had been sent by the chief priests and the Pharisees. They carried torches, lanterns, and weapons. So they were Roman soldiers. Pilate would have had to authorize the use of Roman soldiers to arrest Jesus. So the gospel writer is making explicit that they are working together on this, although they clearly don't like each other, and we'll look at that more in a minute. The story of Pilate and Jesus is set in seven scenes, as can be seen in this cartoon version. Pilate moves outside to speak to the Jewish religious leaders, the first scene, then back inside to question Jesus, then back out, then as Jesus flogged in the fourth scene, then back out again, back in for one last set of questions, and then back out for a final time. This back and forth between the accusers and Jesus has been interpreted as representing how Pilate is vacillating, not knowing what to think and do. And that may well be the case, but this was also a well-known literary style of not having more than two characters or two groups of characters at a time in a scene. I'm not sure whether that was for dramatic effect or for the sake of clarity, but it was a well-known way of framing a story like this one. So we're going to briefly look at each of these seven scenes, and then we're going to see what we can learn from it all. We've heard it read, so I'm not going to read it all again, but I'll put the text up on the screen in case you want to follow along, but you don't need to. So in scene one, Jesus has just been questioned by Caiaphas, who you may remember is the Roman governor's appointed high priest. And then Jesus is taken to Pilate at his Jerusalem residence. We know he's there because it's the time of the Passover festival. And on this occasion, Pilate shows some religious sensitivity in coming out of the palace to meet the religious leaders so that they can stay pure or clean. Now, of course, there's a heavy dose of irony here. They are handing over Jesus to be executed, even though they know he's innocent. So the idea that going into the palace is what's going to make them unclean is, it's kind of laughable. Pilate had sent his soldiers to arrest Jesus, so he would be expecting the Jewish leaders, and he asked them what the formal charge would be. And their response to the Roman governor comes across as pretty insolent. They say, if he were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you. This sounds a little frustrated on their part, maybe. This is meant to be a joint operation. Presumably they had agreed that Jesus was a threat to the peace. So why the need for formal charges? Why can't they just have him executed? And Pilate's response is equally sharp. He says, you do it then. You take him yourselves and judge him by your own law. That's what you want to do. Pilate knows they don't have the power to execute Jesus. And so he puts them in their place. He reminds them that he has judicial authority. He is the one who can judge Jesus. In scene two, Pilate asks Jesus if he is the king of the Jews, which is apparently the formal charge, claiming to be the king of the Jews. But this is a question that can't be answered with a simple yes or no. A self-proclaimed king in the eyes of Rome is an insurrectionist, which Jesus is not. But king of Israel to the Jewish religious leaders is a claim to be the Messiah, which Jesus is, but not the kind of Messiah that they're anticipating. So either way, Jesus' understanding of what it means to be a king, what it means to have a kingdom, is something completely different to what he's being charged with. So Jesus starts to explain, my kingdom is not of this world. My kingdom is from another place. It's not in another place. He's not saying he's king of heaven somewhere else. The kingdom is among us. It's here, but it's from another place. It's a whole different way of being. But Pilate doesn't understand that. And this is the first of several misunderstandings that we'll see in this conversation. This kingdom is about truth. It's about real life. It's about a higher level of consciousness. Truth is actually a major concept in the Gospel of John. There are three words for true and truth that John uses frequently, or the writer of John uses frequently. Aletheia means truth or reality. Alethes means true even despite appearances, something authentic or something that will ultimately be shown to be fact. And alethinos literally means made of truth, true in its very being, genuine, the ultimate reality. And the writer of John's Gospel uses these words 49 times as compared to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, who collectively only use these words 10 times. So truth really is a big deal in this gospel. And in today's passage, Jesus says he testifies to the truth. In chapter 1 of the Gospel of John, the writer says truth comes to humanity from Jesus or through Jesus. Jesus brings truth to the world. In chapter 14, Jesus says that famous line, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the ultimate divine reality." And in chapter 8, Jesus says, "Then you will know the truth, and the truth will set you free." And he goes on to say, "So if the Son sets you free, you will be free indeed." And this, of course, is the whole purpose of this gospel account, that people would know the truth, would know Jesus as the Son of God, and so find freedom from all that is untrue and fake and deceptive, and instead find real life. But Pilate, once again, he doesn't get that. He apparently looks at Jesus, this penniless prisoner, a bound man awaiting sentence, and he scoffs, "What is truth?" and walks away. Now, the question itself, of course, is a great one. What a cool question to be able to ask Jesus. What is truth? But he's not really asking. He doesn't even stay for an answer. He just walks away. So we get to scene 3, back outside again. Pilate has been told that Jesus was a threat to the peace, but he sees now that this is it's a Jewish religious matter. It's really of no interest to him. And at this point, Pilate could just have released Jesus, but he seems to think it prudent to be somewhat cooperative with the Jewish religious leaders. After all, he has to work with them. Note, there's no mention of a crowd in John's Gospel. It's apparently just Pilate and the Jewish leaders. And Pilate at this point mocks them and Jesus with his offer to release the king of the Jews. He's mocking their nationalist aspirations. Passover is a festival that celebrates Israel's liberation from Egyptian oppression. It was all about this tiny enslaved nation rising up and overcoming the might of Egypt. And so we have this darkly ironic scene where the spokesman of mighty Rome, the occupying force of the day, offers the true Messiah to the religious leaders, offers the truth, the Son of God who sets people free, and they reject him. In scene 4, Pilate, who's just declared Jesus innocent, has him flogged. Actually, literally, it says Pilate flogged Jesus as the active voice. Now, of course, the Roman governor would not have done this dirty work himself, but the writer here is putting the responsibility squarely on Pilate's shoulders. He's fully culpable for this vicious act of fastening Jesus' hands to a pole, baring his back, and whipping him. But Pilate said Jesus was innocent, so probably this wasn't meant as punishment, but rather as torture intended to get a confession, to beat the truth out of him, as it were. Again, darkly ironic. And in the next scene, Pilate brings Jesus outside, again to mock the nationalist aspirations of the Jewish leaders through Jesus. Jesus by this time must have been a total mess physically. And on top of that, the soldiers have dressed him up as a king for a joke. Jesus is no threat to Rome. That's very evident. "Look at him," says Pilate. "Here is the man." Roman emperors were considered gods. This king is barely even a man. Is this what the Jewish people turn to in hope of liberation? What a joke. The Jewish religious leaders are quick to distance themselves from Jesus and they demand his execution. And again, Pilate mocks their impotence as an oppressed people, telling them to crucify him themselves if that's what they want to do. But then the Jewish religious leaders change tactic. They say Jesus has been making himself the Son of God, and this worries Pilate, at least for the moment. Romans embraced a lot of the Greek myths of gods taking human form or begetting children. So was Jesus somehow mixed up with the gods? Did he have some magical powers, perhaps? Pilate seems worried that maybe he might. So in scene 6, Pilate again goes back inside to question Jesus. And he asks him where he comes from. Now, like, are you the king of the Jews? It sounds like a simple question, but it's really not, particularly from the perspective of the writer of John's Gospel. He starts his book by saying that Jesus had come from God, that he was God and was with God in the beginning, that he came as light in the darkness, as truth that needed to be recognized. But how could Pilate understand that? He didn't even understand that there could be a different kind of kingdom. He was someone who asked questions and then walked out the door before you even had time to answer. Pilate wasn't really asking. He wasn't really listening. He wasn't really searching after truth. But when Jesus didn't answer, Pilate, it seems, got angry. He was used to being obeyed, and immediately. He says, "Don't you know I have the authority, I have the delegated power to release you, and the authority or the delegated power to crucify you?" Now, if we'd read the whole of John's Gospel, this phrasing would have been familiar to us because Jesus says something very similar in chapter 10. Jesus is speaking about his life when he says, "I have authority to lay it down and authority to take it up again. This command I received from my Father." Jesus had authority over his own life, and that power was delegated to him by God the Father. The writer here is putting Pilate's so-called power into perspective. Pilate had boasted to the Jewish religious leaders that he alone had authority to execute Jesus. He'd mocked them for having so little authority. But although Pilate is clearly responsible for his actions in the Gospel of John, the Jewish religious leaders actually have more delegated authority than he does. They're even more responsible for what's about to happen. Despite his arrogance, Pilate is actually not in charge here. And so we come to the final scene. Pilate has apparently seen enough to know that Jesus shouldn't be executed, and he decides to release him. But the Jewish leaders, seeing that the religious charge has actually had the opposite effect of the one they were hoping for, referred back to a political accusation and make this thinly veiled threat to report Pilate to Caesar if he doesn't get rid of this person claiming to be king. The account at this point says, "He sat down on the judge's seat," but the wording is not clear as to whether it was Pilate or Jesus who sat down. Now, of course, we would fully expect from a historical sense that the governor would sit in the place of judgment and make his pronouncement. But from a literary sense, this ambiguity may be intentional. There's been a big deal made of who is actually in charge, who has real authority. Pilate has repeatedly reminded the Jewish leaders that they don't have any power to order an execution. And of course, we know that the limited authority they do have has been granted to them by Rome. But Jesus has also made the point that Pilate is not really in charge. Jesus' authority supersedes that of Pilate, having been delegated directly by God the Father. So who is judging who? Well, any superstitious fear that Pilate might have had of Jesus being somehow mixed up with the gods seems to have been replaced by a more practical fear of having a negative report made to Caesar. And Pilate returns to his mockery, presenting to the Jewish leaders their king. And Pilate agrees to do as they ask, but he exacts a high price. He manipulates the leaders into admitting their allegiance to Rome. So at this holy time of the Passover, this sacred celebration of God's supremacy over earthly rulers, the chief priests declare, "We have no king but Caesar." This is a mic drop moment. This is a shocking statement, perhaps the most shocking statement possible for them to make. It's a total betrayal of God, a total betrayal of the Jewish religion and of the hopes of the Jewish people to be free from Roman oppression. "We have no king but Caesar." Pilate has won. He's shown the religious leaders to be without principle, without honor, and he hands Jesus over to be crucified. This is a really powerful story, and Pilate is, I think, a fascinating character, but one that I'm sure we don't really identify with. I hope we don't, anyway. If anyone's thinking, I had someone flogged just the other day. That would not be a good thing. So how do we relate to this story? What can we take away from it, particularly as it pertains to our own conversations? Well, first, maybe we can ask ourselves, are we really looking for truth? Or perhaps, like Pilate, we are more interested in keeping the peace and maintaining the status quo. Because truth can be disruptive. Imagine for a moment what would have happened if Pilate, instead of scoffing, "What is truth?" and walking out the door, had instead sat down and said, "Tell me, Jesus, what is truth? What do you mean by truth?" What if he had genuinely listened and sought to honestly engage? How different would things have been? If he'd really been open to the truth, Pilate's whole life would have been turned on its head. Are we open to that? But of course, Pilate would never really listen to Jesus because he was a penniless foreigner, a prisoner, a Jew. What could he possibly know? Pilate arrogantly assumed that Jesus could have nothing to teach an important person like the Roman governor. How open are we to learning from unexpected sources? From people who maybe don't seem all that impressive to us, who don't have the credentials we look for, who don't speak like us or look like us, who don't share our worldview, don't share our religion even. Are we still willing to listen? Are we still open to learning from them? Second, are we willing to let go of control? Power and authority are major themes in this conversation. Who is in charge? Who gets to call the shots? Pilate seems to put an awful lot of value on his own authority. He is the one who gets to say what happens, not the Jewish leaders, and certainly not Jesus. But listening, really being open to learning, being open to change, means being willing to cede control. How many conversations have you had where you know that the other person is not really listening to you, where you can see that they're just waiting to give you their next response? They have a fixed idea of where the conversation needs to go and they're going to take it there. How many times have we done that to ourselves? Especially with polarized issues or sensitive issues like our religious beliefs or our thoughts on race or economics or politics, issues where we can quickly become very defensive. If our objective is to maintain control of the conversation, the chances are we won't learn anything. And maybe, back to my first point, we don't really want to learn anymore. Maybe we've become cynical, jaded. Maybe we too scoff at such lofty concepts as truth and reality, a kingdom from above. Maybe we pride ourselves on being down to earth. I have a couple of teenagers. And many teenagers, and kids in general really, are great at asking big questions and making kind of idealistic, sweeping, big, bold statements. Teenagers are often not great at nuance, but they're still able to look at the world with fresh eyes and not just assume that the way things are is the way things need to stay. And one of my kids pretty regularly makes big pronouncements, and several times he's called me out for being a little dismissive with a, you know, kind of a, "Well, you'll see things differently when you're older," kind of a response. Do we have that kind of cynicism? I know I do. Are we willing to let go of it? Admitting that we don't have all the answers can be humbling. Admitting that we can learn from people who are younger than us or less powerful than us in some way, less educated, less competent, less successful, however we measure that. That can be humbling. But of course, none of us have all the answers. We are all, hopefully, growing. So can we embrace that? Can we embrace mystery? Pilate couldn't. He wanted clear-cut answers in his terms. But if truth is ultimately Jesus, if it's ultimately relational, then there are questions that simply don't have clear-cut answers. Rather, there's a need to embrace a process of growing into the truth, of developing that higher consciousness, of becoming more like Jesus. And if we think we can reduce truth to a set of simple statements, we've perhaps missed the point. But embracing mystery, being okay with not having all the answers worked out, that can be very uncomfortable. Are we open to that? And finally, are we open to admitting that we get it wrong, that we make mistakes? Can we embrace that as normal, as part of being on a journey? Can we have that kind of humility? There may be things we've believed, maybe for decades. Maybe we taught them to our kids. Maybe we lost relationships over them. And now we see things differently. I know that's true for me. There are things that I have believed in the past that I now think are quite unloving. They don't bring real freedom. They don't bring life. They don't look like the kind of truth we see in Jesus. And I'm pretty sure that in years to come, I'll look back on this time and think, did I really believe that? At least I hope I'll think that, because hopefully that will mean I'm still growing. The writer of John's Gospel seems to suggest that misunderstandings are part of what it means to grow into the truth. People got it wrong all the time in their conversations with Jesus. But by making those mistakes and continuing the conversation, they grew to understand who Jesus really is. Can we have that kind of humility? And that kind of compassion on ourselves and compassion on others. We're all learning, hopefully. We're going to make mistakes. We are going to have to rethink things, and that's okay. Let's continue the conversation. Let's grow into the truth. Let's enter more into what the kingdom of God really means, what real freedom, real life is all about. We're going to take communion in a moment. I think it's interesting that Jesus told his friends to eat and drink together as a way of remembering him. He didn't leave them with a creed or a statement of beliefs. He took the very ordinary act of eating and drinking and imbued it with all kinds of meanings. Theologians have been arguing for centuries over what communion really means. How should it be interpreted? Even just here at Cedar Ridge, we presented communion in so many different ways. As a symbol of our shared humanity, of Jesus' willingness to suffer because of his love for us, of our willingness to follow in the way of Jesus, of our hunger for God, of our oneness with God, and so on and so forth. All of which I believe are true. But this simple act carries truth that transcends any one of these interpretations. Because truth is not a list of statements that we agree with. Truth is Jesus, the Son of God, who brings us real life. So let's just take a few moments before we take communion to be still and ponder these words of Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and the life. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. I am. Amen.